Chairman, Dr. Cass, Professor Toynbee, ladies and gentlemen. First, let me clarify that I'm here in my personal and not in my official capacity. Indeed, over the past 48 hours since Professor Toynbee agreed to this debate, I have done very little in the nature of my official capacity, and I'd be more or less traversing beyond space and time, a few thousand years of history back and forth, trying to disentangle civilizations and fossils. Mr. Chairman, in this hall last week, an analogy was made, a comparison was drawn, and a word was involved, evoked, a word also enshrining a concept, the word of morality. Morality is a word of great significance, touching the destiny of individuals, of nations, of the international community. But it was invoked by Professor Toynbee in even a broader canvas, in the canvas of history, in terms of history's spiritual coherence and purpose. I agree fully with a remark made by Professor Toynbee and reported in the press as to the nature of the world crisis of the present time. All agree today that this crisis lacks adequate definition. The common man, like the statesman, realize that in mankind's hands is reposed the crucial alternative of self-destruction or of redemption, of a new insight into history's purpose or of oblivion. And all realize that only through a decisive leap forward in the spiritual consciousness of mankind can the answer be found to this human dilemma. In the attempt at civilization in our time, and I'm using a phrase of Professor Toynbee, this leap forward must come from a deeper sense of morality. Before this body last week, Professor Toynbee, according to the newspapers of Montreal, compared from a moral standpoint the attitude of Israel to the Arabs in 1947 and 48 with the Nazi slaughter of 6 million Jews. Let me say a word on this comparison. I must first say that the professor clarified that he was not comparing the two events statistically, but he insisted, so the papers say, that the moral comparison is valid. Secondly, he is quoted as having said the Jews had no historical right to Israel. Now, as far as one aspect of this analogy, the Nuremberg International Court made a finding that in the summer of 1941, plans were made for the final solution of the Jewish question in Europe. This final solution, as we all know, embraced, in fact, the putting to death in circumstances of unprecedented cruelty of 6 million of our people, including over 1 million children. It is a crime which human imagination still finds difficulty in grasping. In the biblical phrase, the earth cannot cover the blood in which it is soaked. There was here cold-blooded planning. There was government responsibility. There was execution to the magnitude of 6 million. And there was the result that a third of the Jewish people was wiped out, the great centers of its religion, of its thought, its culture, its social national movement, were obliterated. Professor Toynbee himself has denounced this crime in incisive terms. Indeed, till the end of days, mankind will brood the significance of this specter, unprecedented, of man's inhumanity to man. And as for my people, our mourning is endless. It is a mourning to eternity. Let us take the other side of the analogy. In 1947, over two-thirds of the members of the United Nations took a decision on partition with separate Jewish and Arab states. The Arab representatives on the spot announced they would resist, and within days an armed attack began against the Jewish community in Palestine. Writing on that period, the then United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Trigvi Lee, in his book In the Cause of Peace, page 163, says, from the first week of December 1947, disorder in Palestine had begun to mount. The Arabs repeatedly asserted they would resist partition by force. They seemed to be determined to drive that point home by assaults upon the Jewish community in Palestine. On January the 21st, 1948, the British representative of the United Nations, Sir Alexander Cadogan, told the Security Council that for the Arabs in Palestine, the killing now transcends all other considerations. On the 16th of February, 1948, the United Nations Palestine Commission reported to the Security Council that powerful Arab interests, both inside and outside Palestine, are defying the resolution of the General Assembly and are engaged in a deliberate effort to alter by force the settlement and visage therein. And again in April 48, continued threats and acts of violence. With the expired British mandate on the 15th of May, the Arab armies invaded, informed the United Nations they were intervening in Palestine with the object of establishing right and order in place of chaos and disorder. The nature of this right and order was immediately defined by the Secretary General of the Arab League, Azam Pasha, speaking in Cairo. I'm quoting a BBC broadcast, 15th of May, 48. He says the world would now see a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and crusades. It was a war. There was heavy suffering on both sides, casualties, military and civilian. Through this war, large numbers of Arabs in Palestine were uprooted. At the same time, through this war, large Jewish communities throughout the Middle East were uprooted. On both sides, there was heavy suffering. Large numbers of Arabs left the country in order to come back in the wake of the victorious forces. No international authority has defined responsibility for the Arab refugee problem. It is our contention, and we can sustain this contention through Arab and other, including British sources, the refugee problem was the result of the war proclaimed by the Arabs and the result of an appeal by the leaders to leave in order to return. As an Arab newspaper in Jordan put it, they told us to get out so that we can get in. We got out, they did not get in. But let us look at the results. There's an analogy in terms of morality, Professor. Yes. Of the Arab population, there are now 200,000 in Israel enjoying equality and every right, side by side with the Jewish fellow citizens. I represent these Arab citizens, just as I represent Jewish citizens, because they're all Israeli citizens. In the refugee camps, it is true, there are large numbers of Arab refugees. At the same time, quite considerable part of them have been absorbed in the economy of neighboring countries. But even those in the camps, despite their suffering, there are many of them working, and over the past 13 years, their number has increased. In any event, there's a difference even between a parasitic existence and between total extinction. They continue to suffer because the Arab governments, who originated this suffering, refused to relieve it by cooperating in the settlement of the Arab refugee problem. It is the same line of suffering died right down since 47 with the same source. Professor, there is a relationship between the two events to which you referred. The relationship is that in both cases, the Jewish people was assaulted. In one case, a third of our people were destroyed. In the other, we resisted in self-defense. And under a merciful providence, we succeeded. The second point of relationship is that through the experience of this Holocaust in Europe, our will strengthened. But we would do everything in our capacity that never again should such a tragedy befall our people. But how can the two events of the destruction of a third of our people and of the Arab refugee problem created through a war started by the Arabs themselves, how can the two be mentioned in the same breath? Should we pass an amendment to Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations on the right of self-defense? An amendment which says if you are attacked, you may resist. But remember, no matter what you suffer in the process, if the man attacking you suffers, you will be condemned by history. You will be condemned as having been affected by Nazi influences. You speak, Professor, with respect of Gandhi, of his concepts. You link him across the span of history to Rabbi Jochanan ben Zakkai, one of our great masters of the law at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. But I would say this, that as far as I've read, Gandhi, while opposing activist self-defense, never denounced those who pursued it. What should we have done? Allowed the Nazi experience to be repeated, be butchered? Now, the criterion of moral defensibility, I submit in all respects, sir. In this case, it is vague and indiscriminate. Morality, unless specified and clearly defined, does not strengthen morality, but weakens it. Indeed, one might say it is a case of neutral moralism. Ernst Renan has spoken of la vérité et dans les nuances. But here you don't even have the nuances. You have two entirely different contexts of right and wrong. Professor, I would appreciate if you could clarify for me and for those present what exactly you meant by this statement which was quoted in the Montreal press.
Boxers shake hands before they touch. Now, perhaps that's rather a good example for ambassadors and professors. I'm afraid we shan't give such an entertaining performance as the boxers might do, but still, this is a very important and serious occasion. As the ambassador has said, there are one or two other questions which he and I both want to discuss in your presence. The big one and the first one is this question of the parallel that I drew in a book that I published in 1954 between what the Nazis did to the European Jews and what the Israelis did to the Palestinian Arabs, which was brought up in one of the questions that were put to me at the meeting the other day in Hillel House. And I answered, yes, I had written that. I said, yes, in the terms in which I'd stated it in print in this book of mine, I still held to it. Now, the ambassadors really anticipated one point in telling you very kindly that when I originally made this statement, and when I repeated it the other day, I did say at the same time that I was not making a numerical comparison, because obviously there is no numerical comparison between figures running into millions and figures that run into three or most four figures. The second set of figures I'm talking about, the massacres of Arab civilians behind the lines during the war between the Arab states and the Israeli forces in 1948. Every increase in numbers produces an increase in suffering, but it's impossible to be wicked or criminal more than 100%. Let me put the point bluntly. If murder one man, that makes me a murderer. I don't have to reach the 1,000 mark or the million mark to be a murderer already. I wonder if there are any Egyptians in the room. I know there are a number of Egyptians in Montreal. Is there any Egyptian present? Perhaps not. Well, let us... let me suppose that some of the Egyptians in Montreal were here at this moment and would say to me, how do you, being an Englishman, defend the slaughter in the fall of 1956 of civilian inhabitants of the Egyptian town of Port Said by bombardment from the air, which ran into four figures on the admission of the British government itself, which afterwards sent somebody to investigate, and he couldn't get it down below four figures, if I remember right. Now, supposing I have to answer, why, that's not murder. We only kill people up to four figures. Now, to be a murderer, you must reach the million mark. Now, those Germans over there, they reached it and they murdered several million people, so they're murderers, but we, the British, were not murderers. Now, what did you think of that answer? What would Egypt say and what would the world say? Now, I think that applies all round to all cases. Now, the massacres, I must use the word, to which I am referring, I was not in making this comparison referring to the fighting between the armed forces of the Arab states and the Israeli forces. The situation was, as you know, that the Arab states from outside Palestine did make war on Israel. I do not defend that. And at that time, what is now the territory of Israel was inhabited by the local Arab population, which had been there for many centuries, and by the Israelis who'd come in since 1917. The victims were the local Palestinian Arab population. Now, we come to this point of morality. I utterly agree with the ambassador that this is the essential point, and the point which concerns the future as well as the past. Now, I've mentioned a case that's painful to me to mention, this British case in 56, to show that I can look at the things my own country has done as well as what other people have done. But I do think if there's any point in my what I've said about the numbers, that in point of morality, some of those massacres by Israeli armed forces in Palestine do compare in, so to speak, moral quality with what the Germans did. What we hate in what the Germans did was it was planned beforehand. carried out cold-bloodedly with tremendous cruelty and with a purpose. Now, I'm afraid I know that all those points applied to the massacres which in numbers don't compare, but I think in quality do compare with what the Nazis did, that were did anyway by, done anyway by certain Israeli armed forces, the Stern Gang, for instance, and the Irgun. I don't know how far the Haganah was also implicated. I've heard it stated, and I've never heard it denied, that after at least one of those massacres, that of the civilian population of all sexes and ages at Deir Yassin to the west of Jerusalem, the Israeli armed forces went round in cars with loudspeakers, speaking in Arabic, and said, we have done this to people of this place. You don't want that to happen to you, get out. Now, every civilian population that is in a war zone or is in danger of death very wisely does get out. Happily, after Hitler came to power in Germany, a minority, unfortunately only a minority, of the Jews in Germany did manage to, difficultly often, to leave Germany in time. Now, the Germans, they couldn't take their lives any longer, but they could indeed take and seize and hold their property. No one thinks that the European Jews who got out of Germany at that time forfeited their legal right to their property as a result of having managed by prudence and foresight to save their lives and their families' lives by getting out in time. If we take another case, in 1940, when the Germans invaded France, several million French people from northern France fled from northern France to the south for the same reason that the Arab population of the war zone in Palestine in 1948 fled from Palestine. No one, I think, would dream of saying that by flying, as all civilian populations do try to fly from a war zone, those French people forfeited their title to their land, property, houses, and so on in northern France. And if the Germans were to put in a claim today, as we invaded the country and these French people were ill-advised enough to run away, we have a legal title to this property, and it's really rather a shame and illegal that we don't possess it now, that would seem pretty fantastic. But as you will realize, the position in Israel today is that by far the larger part, I suppose, of the land in Israel is legally still the property of civilian Arab population of Palestine, which fled from Palestine during the war between the Arab states outside Palestine and the Israelis. The property that does rightfully belong to the Israelis is the property that they bought during the 30 years of the Mandate, and, oh, long before that. I think the if I'm right, the first agricultural Jewish settlements in Palestine go back to the 1880s, the Rothschild settlements. Now, they paid a very handsome price very often for that land, and that land is obviously not only legally but morally and fairly their property. But it's, if I'm right in my figures, a smallish proportion of the total land in the area now held by Israel, by far the larger proportion, and also the houses, movable property, fruit trees and so on, is still the rightful property of the Palestinian refugees who are now living outside their homes, or often within sight of them, and are living under conditions of misery and at present of hopelessness. Let me now make a general point, which concerns not Arab human nature or Jewish human nature, but I'm afraid human nature of all of us. And as I say, of all of us, let me begin again with my own country. In the Second World War, the civilian population in my country, Britain, was severely bombed. What did we do within 11 years of that? The end of the war was 45. In 1956, we bombed in an aggressive attack on Egypt without declaration of war and condemned by the world having done it. We bombed the civilian population of particularly Port Said, to some extent to Cairo, I think, as well, and slaughtered certainly more than 1,000 innocent people. Probably rather more than were slaughtered in those massacres by the Israeli armed forces in 48 of Palestinian Arab civilians during the war between the Israelis and the Arab states. Now, this is a tragedy of human nature. What is the real tragedy is that people who have suffered a thing, have had experience of it, should inflict that suffering on other people. Because human imagination is a very sluggish thing, and it's very hard to realize at second hand what it means to suffer these things. But of course, the British people, just during one war, they suffered this bombardment just for a few years. The Jewish people have suffered murder, robbery, expulsion from their homes, not just for a year or two, but for centuries, running into about 2,500 years, shall we say. The more experience one has of what this means, I would say, the more it is morally incumbent on one not to do the same thing again. The temptation to work it off, one's exasperated, is no doubt greater, but the moral duty to resist that temptation is at its maximum. One curious feature about the effect of this comparison that I've made, I've been surprised at the vehemence of the reaction to it in the Jewish community. I've wondered myself why, when it is felt to be rather a preposterous comparison, as you obviously feel it to be, you haven't said, here's a silly man saying a silly thing, why bother about it? It's so silly, leave it alone. But the reaction has not been like that. It's been, as we know, very vigorous. I think here I'm going to say a rather controversial thing, that any psychologist would tell you the reason. I would say that, rather inadvertently, in this comparison I've drawn, I have given the Jewish people a piece of what psychologists call shock treatment. I have said aloud, in startling words, I think something that your consciences, each of you who belong to the Jewish community of the world, are whispering inside each of you. Now, let my voice fade out for a moment and listen to another voice, which I'll quote. I am certain that the world will judge the Jewish state by what it will do with the Arabs. Now, as I say, those aren't my words. They're the words of a man famous in all your minds, Chaim Weizmann, whom I had the honor to know when I was a young man, who was the first president of Israel. And they were spoken, I believe, written in 1949, after the war between the Arab states and Israel, and when Dr. Weizmann was the first president of Israel. But I would ask you, don't let my voice fade out, let even Dr. Weizmann's voice fade out, and listen to your own inner voice inside each of you. Because, after all, who was it who were the first to wake up the human conscience? I would say it was the prophets of Israel and Judah. I do not believe that any person of Jewish religion can ever escape from his own conscience. And what's more, I don't believe any Jew ever wishes to escape from his own conscience. And I believe it has been the glory of the Jews since the time of the prophets and perhaps before, that in all controversial questions between Jews or between Jews and the rest of the world, there have always been Jews who have had the spiritual insight and the moral courage to stand up and criticize their people. We shouldn't know what the criticisms of the Jews in the 8th and 7th centuries BC were if we hadn't got the writings of Jewish critics who had criticized them. And so I would leave you with your own consciences and with the existence of these Arab refugees who now number 900,000, because many children have been born in exile. So, as I say, I leave it to you to think over in your own consciences what is to be done about this situation, because we have opened a problem and we have not yet solved it.